Welcome to Steppin' Out of Babylon, produced by Sue Supriano. Babylon is everywhere. It's the isms and schisms not only within the system, but within ourselves. Let's unify, stand aligned, and step out of Babylon.
Hi, everybody. My name's Sue Supriano, and my guest today is Carwell James. Carwell works with Project Underground in Berkeley here, where we're doing this interview, Berkeley, California. And Project Underground works with Ecuador, for one, which is going to be the main subject of this show, is what's going on in Ecuador. But first, I think I'm just going to ask Carwell to explain what Project Underground does do.
Project Underground is a human rights organization based in Berkeley. There are 12 of us, and we work together to support the human rights of communities resisting the mining and oil industries. And we do that by providing information to those communities, to people in resistance, and also by taking on particular campaigns. On the oil side, we are currently supporting the Uwa people and their resistance against Occidental Petroleum from drilling on their sacred homeland in northeastern Colombia, and working together with peoples of the Niger Delta who are confronting Chevron, which is a hometown company for us. Chevron has been involved in structural and institutional racism and environmental damage and human rights abuses within the Niger Delta. We also work on mining campaigns around Newmont Gold Mining Corporation, which is the United States' largest gold mining corporation, and also in a neighbor to Ecuador. We're working to support the Rondas Campesinas, who are opposing the Yanacocha gold mine, which has produced all kinds of mercury spills, water degradation, and a variety of pollution effects for them for many years.
Mm-hmm. I think that on your brochure it says, which I'm not looking at this moment, but it says something about human rights and the environment, and they sure do go together a lot of times, because by screwing up the environment, you're also screwing up the humans that live on the planet, not to mention all the other beings, plants and animals. Right now, what we're going to focus on right here is Ecuador, the country of Ecuador, which is a pretty small country in South America. I have a particular strong feeling of connection, since I've spent some time there and have friends there, and very, very fond memories of it. And it's a very beautiful place, and I think it's one of the most biodiverse countries in the world. And right now, what's happening this week as we speak, which is the beginning of February or February 9th, the U.S.-backed Ecuadorian colonial regime has started killing the indigenous people of Ecuador. And I'm reading from a flyer here that Project Underground put out. So the Ecuadorian colonial regime has started killing the indigenous people of Ecuador in an effort to enforce IMF, International Monetary Fund, mandated policies, which are casting the people of Ecuador into extreme poverty and destroying their environment in order to satisfy the insatiable profit requirements of multinational corporations, as well as making Ecuador available as a base for U.S. military intervention in South America. Well, I just wanted to read that because it's a very strong statement, and it seems to me that's what's happening from what I know. So, but fill in the details, Carwell.
Sure. Well, what we saw this week, really starting somewhat last week, but really kicking in on Saturday, was that the Ecuadorian government decided that the way to respond to a national indigenous uprising, a national indigenous and peasant uprising.
And I'm going to interrupt you and say that Ecuador, I think, has the biggest percentage of indigenous people living traditionally anywhere in South America. It's way over 50%, I think, but continue.
Yep. So indigenous peoples who make up a very a very large percentage of Ecuador, and also campesinos, including a lot of Afro-Ecuadorians, took part in a national uprising. And that is really the culmination of about a decade of really hard, consistent organizing by the indigenous peoples, who have felt both from economic policies and from the corporate and government colonization of indigenous lands, particularly in eastern Ecuador, in the Oriente region, the part that is part of the Amazon rainforest. They've seen a systematic effort with oil companies like Texaco and like Arco coming in at the same time as the government comes in, and it's an assault on their environment and on their culture. And when indigenous folks and poor folks all across Ecuador have rose up, have resisted, they faced human rights abuses. And so this was a concerted uprising to demand a new model for the way that Ecuador would be governed, and one that was not one that was dictated by the International Monetary Fund, which has put some very harsh conditions onto Ecuador. And in that, they were joined by a variety of other social movements. They were joined by the National Women's Movement. They were joined by environmentalists. They were joined by human rights supporters all across the country. And they were joined by the unions, who engaged in a national strike this past Wednesday in support of the indigenous uprising. So all across the political spectrum in Ecuador, all of the major sectors that represent, you know, these fundamental aspects of humanity really rose up in a concerted way together and challenged the Ecuadorian government and the IMF and U.S.-backed policies that it's been carrying out. And what we saw this week was a brief, fortunately brief, attempt by the government to put down this uprising, to say that to really take on their people as a whole, using guns, using sticks, and using detention. On Saturday, there was a declaration of emergency by the Ecuadorian government, which empowered the military and the police to go throughout the country to use whatever force they deemed necessary against the protests, and also stripped Ecuadorians of their fundamental rights to freedom of association, to freedom of speech, to freedom from arbitrary search and seizure, and from freedom from arbitrary detention. And hundreds of people were detained. Tens of them were injured by gunshots, and four people died as a consequence of that wave of repression. And it was met by escalating resistance, more and more solidarity, and a lot of international solidarity, people from outside really calling on the Ecuadorian government to respect the rights of its people. Mm-hmm. I wanted to take an opportunity to read just a little of what one of the delegations of protesters in Ecuador said about the International Monetary Fund, because it's an extremely important part of these protests is that Ecuador has been under pressure to raise the prices of basic necessities, to cut off access to basic services, and to really use policies that put the burden of Ecuador's massive debt onto the poor people of Ecuador, who have never benefited from any of the loans that have come to them.
Okay, before you do that, I want to say something, because I was there a couple of years ago, and actually there was a general strike in the whole country. I was totally astounded at this. The gasoline prices got raised about four times, something like that, of what they had been. And, of course, we're talking about Ecuador being an oil-producing country. And, of course, most people are poor. I say of course because it's so often the way. And this would really, needless to say, influence everything, these high gas prices. And people went immediately, were on the roads, blocking the roads. It was very different than the United States. I was very amazed at how quickly people went into action and the kind of pride and the kind of courage they had to stand up against the government. I was quite happily flabbergasted, and I was in Quito some of the time, the main city, and I was very impressed by the degree the degree of relaxation of the military and the police, it was very different than in this country. And so I don't know exactly what the IMF has done, but I'm sure they must really, really be squeezing the country to come to this, because I can personally testify that this is a big change from a couple of years ago, which I'm not saying was a piece of cake, and the government did back down, but it was only for a minute because the pressures on them are so strong.
Yeah, so what went on this time, and what's gone on, I mean, the big factors in Ecuador's economy in the past couple of years have been a new wave of IMF policies, and especially around the dollarization of the economy, so that all of Ecuador is being converted from a national Ecuadorian currency to a currency that's run for a country that is much larger, much more prosperous, and just with a lot more access to capital than it is. And that means that Ecuador's poor have to face the same kind of prices and the same kind of economic squeeze that people in the United States do, but obviously with far fewer dollars in their pockets. And part of that, part of the IMF-sponsored proposals were a doubling of fuel prices overnight, a 75% increase in transit prices all across the country. So a lot of people don't rely on transit fuel. They rely on fuel to put warm food on their tables, and they rely on the public transit system to get them where they need to go. And they were suddenly seeing themselves being completely denied regular access to that. And so that's been a squeeze that's been going on for months now, and it's a squeeze that in which there's been a lot of organizing. There was a similar uprising about a year ago, which actually resulted in the brief toppling of the Ecuadorian government. And for a while, there was, for just about 24 hours, actually, there was a provisional government which included indigenous representation in a three-person government that came out of the social movements. It had someone from the military, which is often has really, like, because it's conscripted members of the poor, who are the vast majority of Ecuador, and because it's had a sense of some sense of obligation, some sense of being in the community, and it derives its legitimacy from everyone going along with what it does, they and the Ecuador's indigenous people and Ecuador's unions came together and had this three-part government that lasted for 24 hours until the U.S. said, we have no interest in recognizing it. We're going to block any loans, any aid, any international credit to it. And so it was, you know, they stepped down and they were replaced immediately by the former vice president, who went on to carry out the same kind of policies that had led to the revolt in the first place.
And that was mostly because of the United States government.
It was United States pressure. And certainly the United States has been the arbiter of legitimacy throughout throughout the hemisphere, giving its blessing to countries as quote-unquote democratic, even when there's massive paramilitary abuse of opposition parties, when people are shot for joining in a third party, as is in the case in Colombia, when people standing up for their human rights are shot down, but also being the arbiter against popular movements gaining control over a government, as we're seeing in country after country. And so the Ecuadorian indigenous people, who had done so much organizing and built so much of a base of strength, promised that, you know, if things did not change, that they would be back to Quito and they would be back in force in this kind of uprising all across the country, nonviolently occupying streets and roads and shutting down transport from parts of the between parts of the country, and also organizing local alternative governments all across the country that. Where people would come together in assemblies and be able to say what it was that they wanted from their government, and what it was that they wanted in terms of their development and their economy. And, you know, that's a very different model than the, you know, oil-based, timber-based, agro-export-based model that's imposed by the International Monetary Fund.
It sounds wonderful. It sounds totally fantastic that for people to come together in community and all over the country, people who often can't even read or write, and come together with these ideas in a democratic fashion. That's what we're supposed to want. What's what we're supposed to be for in the United States. But yet again, just yesterday, I did an interview about the war in Colombia that's against the people, pretty much. It's killing a lot. Well, there's a lot of violence in Colombia, and it's also spilling over into Ecuador. I guess that's partly why the United States wants this base. That's part of the issues here about,
It's very important that you bring that up, because one of the major issues in Ecuador and one of the major issues that's shaping up all across Latin America is this United States plan for Colombia that's called Plan Colombia, which is in part a militarization plan. It's a way of shipping down $1.3 billion in arms and training and military helicopters and the like to the Ecuadorian military. But it's also a plan that relies on an IMF structural adjustment plan and a plan that envisions a certain type of economic development for Ecuador for Colombia. And what the people of Colombia have said, and what the National Indigenous Organization of Colombia has said, is that there's no place for indigenous peoples in Plan Colombia. And the UWA, who have been resisting Occidental Petroleum, see Plan Colombia as just arming those people who threaten to push them out, who threaten to terrorize them for their resistance, arming the paramilitaries, arming the military, which has been involved in displacing them repeatedly, and also putting up a green light for more companies like Occidental Petroleum to come in. So the UWA have said of Plan Colombia, this is a death sentence for us. And the indigenous peoples of Ecuador have been listening to that. Last June, there was the National Confederation, or the Confederation of Indigenous Nationalities of Ecuador, staged a one-day takeover of the Occidental Petroleum offices in Quito, Ecuador, in solidarity with the UWA. And once again, in this national uprising, they made as their central two of their central demands points in solidarity with the people of Colombia. And those points were that the Manta military base, which is the site of the largest U.S. contingent of military placed abroad in Latin America at this point, and which is the key base or a key base for supporting the regional militarization that's brought about in Plan Colombia, that base right now is being treated in part as territory that's effectively U.S. sovereign territory, territory where the United States government has the veto for what goes on in it. And so one of the demands of the indigenous movement was the resumption of national sovereignty over the Manta military base. And the second of the Colombia-related demands was that the government publicly come out against the regionalization of Plan Colombia. Now we've gotten to talk about a number of what the demands are, I should point out that on Wednesday afternoon, there were negotiations between the government and the indigenous leaders, and those negotiations were at first between the vice president of each, because the president would not deign to meet with the indigenous peoples, but they resulted in a groundbreaking accord, which calls for the reduction of the prices of fuel, the availability of public transport all across the country at half fare to the elderly, to students, and to youth, that calls for additional funding for government agencies that fund local government and local visions and as far as health development and as far as educational development, all across their demands, they were largely being met. And what was met on the Plan Colombia issue was a government renunciation of Plan Colombia. We are still waiting to see, and we are very eager to see, what does this victory translate into for the people of Colombia, for the Manta military base, and for the militarization of the region. But I should add that it's just one more example of how opposition to Plan Colombia is growing. We've had statements from the Mexican government saying that they're lukewarm about it, and that the critics of it need to be listened to. We've had a very harsh critique coming out of the European Parliament, representing all of Western Europe, which rejected Plan Colombia as it's currently put out, and oppose the militarization of Ecuador, or of Colombia. And we've also had statements by 60 of the leading civil society organizations in Colombia, including the National Indigenous Confederation, the National Workers Confederation, you know, on and on and on, for these national level groups that come together, have come together and said, we reject Plan Colombia. And so it's clear that Plan Colombia and the structural adjustment plan in Ecuador and the all these oil developments, they are the product of the United States government, of U.S. corporations, and a very small national elites. But they're, it's very, very obvious that they're not the product of the broad desires of the people of these countries.
Mm-hmm. Maybe we could talk a little bit about what structural adjustment is, because I don't know, practically every interview I do, it comes back down to the International Monetary Fund and this, in structural adjustment. But I don't know that the average person really understands what it is. Maybe some do, some don't.
Sure. So around the early 1980s, a lot of southern countries, countries in the global south, had accumulated fairly substantial debts. And there are two real reasons for that. One is that they were often saddled with colonial debt. So even many countries had to take on the price of repressing the movements that brought them independence as part of their national debt. And also because they had to respect the rights of northern corporations to continue having access to their resources until, say, the mid-1970s, when some of those resources were brought back under national control. And thirdly, because in the 1970s, there was a lot of cash floating around in the international economy, and a lot of governments, many of them undemocratic, were loaned a lot of money. They purchased weapons with them. They filled out, in Latin America, they filled out the power of a lot of repressive military regimes up and down the continent. And they also went into the pockets of the very elite. But by the 1980s, international bankers were no longer as willing to subsidize this, and there was something called the debt crisis was born. And this was a crisis in their... simultaneously for the people who are depending on some of these disbursements and those people who are benefiting from any of the projects that were being funded by them, but also, and the reason it became called a debt crisis, it was a crisis for international bankers because there was no way they could get paid back. Mm-hmm. And what the World Bank and the IMF led was an effort to pay them back anyway, like to reward their irresponsibility, to reward their giving this money to military regimes, to reward their giving this money to corrupt elites, by saying, you're going to get every last penny of it back, and we are going to alter the economies of all these countries in order to make sure that you do. And so, and most of those alterations are based on the idea that they would work in one country at a time, but they're being applied to the majority of the planet, to over 4 billion people living under structural adjustment plans. So people have their currencies devalued so that everything is cheaper in their country, and ideally it would sell more to the rest of the world, except for everyone else's currency is devalued too. Or new areas are opened up to foreign investment, which is supposed to generate new development, but the foreign investment of choice has not been national industries that employ a lot of people. It has been the expansion of extractive industries like timber and the oil industry. And in particular, the oil industry in the 10 years from 1988 to 1998 got new leases to extract and explore for oil and gas in an area the size of the United States and Europe combined. So it was a huge new area of corporate colonization that was a part of the structural adjustment plans.
So the United States facilitated the corporations getting this permission to drill oil, you're saying?
Right. So the United States was the leading player in the IMF and the World Bank. The votes are assigned according to the number of dollars that your country has, and the United States led that process. And the United States then leaned on country by country in its international policies, so that we've been able to trace, for instance, that there are dealings between U.S. government officials and foreign government officials saying, you need to let this company go in, you need to let this company stay in. We've seen it around Occidental Petroleum, both around the case of the UWA, but also in Bangladesh, where they caused a catastrophic fire And the U.S. government said you can't kick them out of your country just because they've caused a national disaster, just because they've cut off half of your country from rail service because of a massive explosion. You need to keep this company in your country. And so it's been a conscious promotion that our government is not acting in our interests, but it's acting in the interests of U.S. corporations.
Yeah. And that oil has really, I mean, we're also dependent on oil and has really horrible effects on people. And to, I mean, I think of the people wading in the oil and washing in the oil and all the animals so that people don't have anything to eat. The animals suffer. It's really, really horrendous. And it's important that people be aware that this is the kind of at the ground level, I guess is what they call it, in terms of where we get our oil and in terms of the politics and our money supporting really the repression of people who stand up against it. That's what you're saying. I know what I was going to say. And that is in all the years I've been doing interviews in international matters, the IMF and the World Bank is behind it every single time. And every single time, the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer. So thank you for explaining that, Carl. Well, and we don't have too much time left, and we want to be able to give the contact number for Project Underground. So get your pencils ready to do that, and maybe you will want to say what you want to say in closing, including what we might do about being support to the people of Latin America.
So my last comment is that in the United States, the country that uses the most oil, which is Ecuador's primary export, and the country that's the source of many of the corporations that are involved here, we have an ecological debt that we owe to the people of Ecuador for the environmental damage that's been caused in the service of our privilege. And so I hope that people will call us up at Project Underground. We're at 510-705-8981. We're on the web at www.moles.org, M-O-L-E-S.org. And I hope that people will join us in holding these corporations accountable, in particular holding corporations like Texaco, which extracted billions of dollars and owes the Ecuadorian people billions of dollars in environmental and social damage. And we're working on a campaign right now that's focusing on Chevron, soon to merge with Texaco, for its role in structural racism around the world. And we hope that a lot of people will get involved in that. And we'll also get involved in efforts to challenge the grip that oil companies, this kind of institutional corporate power and institutional racism that are playing out against the indigenous peoples of Ecuador and the indigenous peoples of Colombia, and playing out all across this country, that we believe that we can build a movement to challenge all of this, and that both corporation by corporation and by together challenging these systems of power, we can bring justice in the form that so many Ecuadorians have secured this week by their movement.
So Project Underground in Berkeley, California. What's the webpage?
www.moles.org.
Thanks so much, Carwell James from Project Underground. And my name's Sue Supriano. Thanks for listening.